The rest of the family, too, grew increasingly fond of the god as the days went on. Ganesha's gaze was so magnanimous. He filled the living room with a sense of quiet peace. Mr. Bloom noticed that Sandra and Judy and David spent longer in that room now. David took to doing his homework on the table under the watching eye of Ganesha. And Mr. Bloom noticed that, though Judy was still dismissive and disdainful of the statue, on the morning before her module exam, she left a badge from her jacket on the sideboard in front of him. She caught her father's eye as she turned to go, shrugged uncomfortably, and said, "For luck, you know." And when Judy did better in that examination than in her teacher's opinions she had any right to, Ganesha came to be looked on in the Bloom family home with a certain warmth. At first, the Blooms did not speak of Ganesha outside their home, but Hendon is not a place for secrets. Perhaps it was that Judy's friend from school, Mikaela, observed her placing a small handful of yellow mandel croutons in front of the god before she started her homework. Perhaps it was that David's friend Benji wondered why David rubbed the statue's head before the final round of every Y tennis computer game. However, it happened. Soon one person spoke to another, and another to a third, and it became known in Hendon that the Blooms, yes, Blooms, the optician, yes, Sandra Bloom of the PTA, yes, that nice David Bloom whose bar mitzvah they'd attended only 2 short years before, those very Blooms had an idol in their house. Now, it was made very clear in the Bible that the introduction of idolatry into a good Jewish home cannot go unchallenged. Were not 3,000 men put to death for worshipping a golden calf? And was it not for this very sin of idolatry that Jezebel was thrown from a window to be devoured by wild dogs? Of course, Barnet Council would be much alarmed should such events come to pass in Hendon, and thus it was that Mr. Bloom was not awakened in the night by a party of eunuchs come to effect his defenstration, but instead received a phone call asking that he should kindly pay a visit to the rabbi at his earliest convenience. The rabbi was a young man, only recently finished with his seminary education. Nonetheless, his beard was neat and his manner suitably deferential to a man of Mr. Bloom's seniority. "Now," he said, steepling his fingers, "I wanted to talk to you, Mr. Bloom, about your statue." "Oh, yes," said Mr. Bloom. He did not feel perturbed. He had found that, since Ganesha had entered his life, he had been less easily disturbed by all vicissitudes. He felt solid. "Yes," said the rabbi. He fiddled with his beard nervously. "The thing is, Mr. Bloom, there's been talk. That is, there has started to be talk. Not, you understand, that I listen to talk. No, not at all. But a man of your position, a trustee of the synagogue, Mr. Bloom." "Talk?" said Mr. Bloom mildly. "About your statue, Mr. Bloom. People are talking about your statue. The rabbi began to speak more quickly, clearly discomfited by Mr. Bloom's silence. The thing is, Mr. Bloom, it doesn't do for a synagogue trustee to have a god, Mr. Bloom volunteered. An idol, said the rabbi. It doesn't do for someone in your position to have an idol in your house. So get rid of it, please. Mr. Bloom thought about how his house had changed since the arrival of Ganesha. It was not, of course, that the family was unrecognisable, not that there was no longer any strife or bitterness. They continued to argue, to complain. Things continued to go wrong. And yet, the quiet presence of the elephant-headed god seemed to have strengthened each of them. Perhaps, thought Mr. Bloom, it was his imagination. And yet, he would rather not give the god up. I think, he said, that I would rather not. The rabbi frowned, leaned forward in his chair, earnest and sincere. Now look here, Mr. Bloom, he said. We can both be reasonable about this, can't we? Of course, you know, and I know, that you don't worship the thing, but can't you see that it looks all wrong? But I do, said Mr. Bloom. Ah, said the rabbi, satisfied. At least you can see that. No, said Mr. Bloom. I mean that I do worship him. And the rabbi sat back suddenly, as if Mr. Bloom, the kindly optician, had struck him in the face. He said after a long pause. We should talk more. Perhaps tomorrow? On the second day, the rabbi telephoned in the afternoon and invited Mr. Bloom to come to talk with him in his study at the synagogue. Mr. Bloom, said the rabbi, obviously a little nervous, I want to talk to you about God. Mr. Bloom smiled and said, That's your field. Rabbi, not mine. The rabbi smiled thinly. Quite. But the thing is, Mr. Bloom, God is really quite specific about idols. Second commandment, you know. No other gods before me. Make for yourself no graven image. It's really very clear. Mr. Bloom nodded slowly. I don't see how you can say that you worship a statue and still keep your place on the synagogue board, you see, Mr. Bloom. I don't see how we can keep you on letting you attend the synagogue at all. Mr. Bloom said mildly, But I still keep the laws. I still pray to God. I'm still a Jew. And the rabbi spread his hands wide and smiled nervously and shook his head and said, Ah, but I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, you know. Mr. Bloom thought of Ganesha, his wide, kind eyes, his welcoming arms. If God is so great, he said, why is he jealous? I thought we weren't supposed to covet. And the rabbi's face darkened, and he said, I can see we will have to talk further about this, Mr. Bloom. And on the third day, Mr. Bloom received another telephone call. It was in the early morning. Mr. Bloom's shop was not due to open for another hour. The rabbi apologised for calling so early and said, Mr. Bloom, I have thought a great deal about what you have said. I think I should see the statue myself. I wonder if you would be able to bring it here to the synagogue this morning. I think that the whole matter could be resolved if you would bring the statue here. Mr. Bloom agreed that he would do so. He had, after all, benefited a great deal from the synagogue and his rabbis. He was still a Jew. Whatever arguments the rabbi might wish to muster, he, Blum, felt honour-bound to hear out. Mr. Blum wrapped Ganesha in a soft blanket and placed him into a sturdy hold all. As he did so, he caressed the curled trunk reverently. He wondered if, like the prophet Elisha, the rabbi intended to challenge Ganesha to a duel with the Almighty, Lord of Hosts. He was intrigued to see which god would prevail. The rabbi was waiting for Mr. Blum at the synagogue gates. The building was old and respectable. Constructed in the 1920s, its solid bricks had housed generations of prayer, of lamentation, and of joyful song. The rabbi led Mr. Blum through the corridors of the synagogue, not into the main prayer hall, but up via a winding cedar-scented staircase to the choir stalls, perched high above the holy closet in which the scrolls of the Torah reside. From here, they could look across the ranged ranks of seats in the synagogue, whose same seats which filled every Friday and Saturday with hundreds of Jews come to worship the one and only God. The rabbi threw the windows at the back of the choir stalls open, inhaled deeply several times, and then turned to Mr. Blum. "Have you bought the idol?" he asked. Mr. Blum noticed that the rabbi, too, seemed stronger and less nervous. Mr. Blum nodded. "Show him to me," said the rabbi. Mr. Blum withdrew the god from the hold-all, unwrapped the soft blanket and held him gently. He thought that perhaps the god was heavier now than when he had bought him. The rabbi's nose wrinkled in disgust. "Do you not know, Mr. Blum, that this thing was made by men? That it is only china and paint? How can you give worship to something that you could construct yourself?" Mr. Blum shrugged. It seemed impossible to explain if the rabbi could not understand it. At last, in an attempt to answer, he said, "I followed my heart and my eyes, but thought that this did not explain one-tenth of what he hoped to communicate." The rabbi looked at Mr. Blum for a long moment. Then, with a little smile, he tugged on Mr. Bloom's arm and brought him to stand by the window too. The synagogue is at the top of a rise, and the whole of Hendon can be seen from its windows, if one is able to peer through the stained glass. "Mr. Blum," said the rabbi, "I hope you know that God loves you." Blum nodded silently. He gazed upon the contemplative and peaceful face of Ganesha. "I have never encountered a case such as this," said the rabbi. "I had to consult with the most senior authorities for a ruling." Blum nodded again. "They were of one mind. You must understand, Mr. Blum, that this is for your own good," said the rabbi. Then, in one fluid motion, too quickly for Mr. Blum to react, the rabbi grabbed Ganesha from Mr. Bloom's hands. He held him for a moment, clutching the god close to his body in an almost protective gesture, and then hurled him in a wide arc through the synagogue window. With a crisply crunching report, Ganesha smashed into 1,000 pieces on the paved area below. "Now, Mr. Bloom," said the rabbi, beaming. "Don't you feel better? Rid of that revolting thing?" Bloom said nothing. He stared down at the paved courtyard of the synagogue, where bright pink and gold fragments radiated from the central point of impact. At length, he allowed the rabbi to lead him away from the window and back to his own home. Late that night, Mr. Bloom, who had been synagogue treasurer for many years and remained a keyholder of the building, silently let himself in through the iron gate of the courtyard. He had bought a fine-haired clothes brush and a carved wooden box from his living room, along with a bag slung over his shoulder containing one or two other heavier items. Slowly, working in circles, he brushed the dust of Ganesha into the box, and when he was finished, dug a small hole in one of the ornamental flower beds and buried it. He wondered if he should say a few words over the grave, but could think of none that might be appropriate. Then, still moving without sound, he opened the door to the main building of the synagogue and slipped through. He had rarely been in this vaulted space alone at night, and never without a specific and necessary errand. He paused now, thinking of the many hours of quiet contemplation this place had afforded him, of the services he had heard intoned here, of the comradely chats, the bustling ceremonial, the joyful celebrations, and the sombre days. The next morning, the synagogue officials were startled to find the building not only locked, but its locks stuffed with wax. Fearing the worst, they called a locksmith who, after some effort, managed to remove the locks bodily from the doors. The officials and, by now, a small crowd who had heard that something might be going on at the synagogue entered and looked around with horror. The synagogue was ruined. The benches were smashed, the drapery torn, the candlesticks twisted, the windows broken. And in the centre was Mr. Bloom, standing with an axe by his side and perspiration soaking through his clothes. And they said, "Why have you done this thing?" And he said, I did not do this. This was done by the Almighty." And they looked around again at the benches with the axe-shaped cuts deeply incised into them, and at the places where the upholstery had been ripped out in quantities the size of a man's hand. And they said, "God did not do this. God cannot destroy in this way." And he said, "Then why do you worship him?" But it is not recorded whether the people were grateful for this enlightenment.